market.
The S&P,
the ASX stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, our special Sunday mailbag edition. I'm Scott Phillips, and with me is Dr. Anirban Mahanty. How are you, Doc?
I'm singing to happiness.
Mate, you... A little bit of inside joke there. The first time we tried to record the intro, Doc was singing in the background. That may or may not set a light of day, depending on how much he pays me to delete the file. Otherwise, you never know. Keep an eye on your podcast feed. You might get a special song from Doc. All right, mate. Let's without further ado, let's get on with it. Now, I will say, as I always do, we're recording this on Thursday. So whatever's happened since, apologies for not covering it. If anything's massive has broken in the last couple of days, let's ask a question from Mitch. Hey, Scott and Doc, loving the pod, long-time listener. Go on, Mitch, thank you. Quick one on ETFs. I keep buying the NASDAQ 100 ETF, the code is NDQ on the ASX, because I'm finding it hard to find an ETF I like more. It's almost my entire ETF portion of my portfolio. Would you consider this undiversified, or would you be comfortable with the heavy exposure to North America and tech? Cheers, Mitch. He leaves a hashtag with hashtag get Doc a better rate. So the hashtag game is strong with our listeners, Doc.
I love it.
It is honestly my favorite part of the mailbag is the inventive hashtags. There's more coming, by the way. Just a quick heads up, including, here's a bit of a spoiler, a question, our first question from a non-human.
I love that.
So stick with that. All right. Let's go back to Mitch though. Hashtag get Doc a better rate. He's got an ETF portion of his portfolio. Now, again, we can't give individual specific advice, as we say every week, but Mitch has got a portfolio which is his ETF portion. I don't know how big that is a portion of his total, but it's all full of NASDAQ. Is that good or is it bad? Is he diversified enough or is he taking too much concentrated risk?
Okay. So without knowing what the rest of the portfolio is, it's hard to say what I would think about the level of diversification, right? So like, yep. For example, NASDAQ is tech heavy. Most of it is tech. And if the rest of your portfolio is also tech, then you know you're
basically, it's a lot of tech.
Then you're basically in tech, right? Yep. Now, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Well, my portfolio is mostly in tech. Yep. It depends. I'm willingly taking that risk. Right. And whether or not you're willingly taking that risk is a question.
And that's like, kind of a different question, right? Because you would say, I'm not diversified, but I'm okay with that.
Yeah,
the
exactly.
Question is, would you consider it undiversified? It's a different question too. Is it a good idea? And they're two questions. We'll probably try and answer both, actually.
Yeah. So, like, I mean, if you're knowingly doing, like, I mean, somebody could technically just own NASDAQ, right?
Right.
And then you would say that it's diversified in the sense that, well, you own 100 different companies, approximately. But at the same time, it would be risky in the sense that, well, you have a heavy tech exposure. And the other risk factor to consider with NASDAQ 100 would be that, a bit like probably off the top of my head, something like 40-45% would be like four or five companies. Maybe.
Yeah. Right.
So that's a pretty heavy concentration in some of the best companies on the planet, period. Yeah. But that is pretty heavy concentration. So that's that part. Like if you hold other things and if you hold other ETFs and this holding of NASDAQ is relatively heavy on that ETF component, but your ETFs are like, say, 30% of your portfolio, maybe it's not a big deal. So I think, so there's a whole range of things to consider. Again, there's it would depend on whether or not, you know, you're, how cognizant you're of the risk and how you are okay with the, riding or not riding the ups and downs that come of tech. But yeah, like, I mean, that's what I would say.
Yeah, I like that. I would invoke. So I own some NASDAQ ETF, by the way, as well as some individual NASDAQ stocks. So full disclosure there. I, for what it's worth, I will invoke the dot bomb crash of 2000, only to say that the more exposed you are to a single industry, you know, when the US market fell 20%, but the NASDAQ fell 80%, that was, you know, and it took, 15 years, I think, to climb back up that peak.
Yeah.
That's the sort of thing you can expect you might expect if you are in an undiversified portfolio or industry or sector. Right now, I'm not saying tech will do it again. There's reasons why tech is better than it was then, largely because most of it's earning profits or at least more sales. So I'm not drawing a straight line. I'm certainly not saying I expect it again. I don't. Otherwise, I wouldn't own the NASDAQ ETF either. But lack of diversification, as we've said in the past, as we will say, here's a spoiler alert, on Tuesday in our Money Hacks edition, it does leave you exposed to more volatility, more potential actual capital loss, right? If tech is permanently valued lower in the future than now for whatever reason, and you don't have anything else in your portfolio, you would expose yourself to that. And as Doc says, if the rest of your portfolio is ASX tech, it is something that will, I mean, you're completely undiversified. Now, I don't think it's a bad thing necessarily. I think you want to be careful about how exposed you are to different sectors. Doc is a risk-tolerant, risk-seeking investor who's really happy to take those risks because he thinks the upside's worth it. I think that's perfectly fine. I'm not as risk-seeking as Doc, but I certainly have a decent exposure in my personal and superannuation for portfolios to the NASDAQ ETF and other tech stocks. So I'm also happy to be in that space, but I'm very, very cognizant. I've had positions in my own portfolio, Doc, that were 40% of my portfolio in the past. So I'm not a risk seeker in terms of lack of diversification on a sector level, but I've certainly been in a situation where I've happily taken much more concentrated risk than other people should. Not because I'm a do as I say, not as I do person, just because I've been doing this for a very, very long time, and my risk tolerance and my emotional response to volatility and loss is actually pretty subdued by now, pretty suppressed. So maybe that's something a therapist can deal with. But in the meantime, that's okay for me. I wouldn't recommend it for other people. Like as Doc says, Mitch, if your ETF portion of your portfolio is 10%, no big deal. If it's 95% and it's all NASDAQ, again, I don't think it's necessarily a terrible thing. You just need to know and really be okay with, like genuinely okay. I've said this before, right? Mentally say I'm okay with that is different from emotionally say I'm okay with that. Plenty of people found out during February and March this year that while they thought they were okay with risk, they really, really, really weren't. When the share market fell, they sold out in March, desperate to avoid more losses, only to miss out on the gains. So there's one thing to say, yeah, I'm ready for it. I mean, we're all humans are all arrogant, right? We all want to think we're better than we are. And this is one of those really, really serious look in the mirror conversations where you say to yourself, all right, I want to believe that's me, but really, am I really, really okay if that happens? As I said, I have become that person over 20 plus years of investing. If you're not someone who's had that experience, just be a little bit careful, right? Know yourself first. And if you're not sure, I would say just be a little bit conservative. Err on the conservative side until you know for sure you can deal with it, because if you have a terrible freak out moment and sell exactly the wrong time, you may well crystallize a few years of losses in one go that might take a bit of time to get back out of.
Yeah, I was just going to add one quick thing, and I'll not, then, you know, one of the things is we can deal with it, but how you deal with it also is important, right? I mean, if your portfolio is down 40% and you don't do anything still,
right,
but
you still
feel immense pain.
Yes.
And therefore, it's also a question, do you want to feel that pain? Yeah, and are you okay being, suffering, right?
Yeah,
so, I mean,
those
are things you have to think about.
No, that's a really, really good point, mate. Because, it's even, there's a process, right? The path to enlightenment, at some point you still manage to not do anything about it, but it still hurts like hell. All right, let's go to the next question from Sam. A really good question from Sam, Doc. I have a feeling you might have a view on this, but let's see. Sam says, morning, fellas. I've got a question for the podcast. I've been reading all the classics on investing. Ben Graham, Peter Lynch, Warren Buffett, Joel Greenblatt, all deep value investors. Now, I will also say at this point, I don't think Peter Lynch would qualify as a deep value investor, but certainly probably not a hypergrowth investor of some like today. So maybe in hindsight, maybe he looks like it, but he certainly was happy to pay up for growth. He had some really high PE stocks in his portfolio. So for what it's worth, just worth holding that out there. But he says, it's left me wondering, how the hell could these guys invest today? The high interest rates that made bonds attractive feel like a distant relic. The margin of safety on stocks has all but disappeared at current PEs. It makes me think, would they sit out right now, as Warren Buffett has? For most, though, we want to put our money to work to beat inflation. What books, etc., would you recommend that take today's metrics, valuations, and tech biotech into account? Are there any must-read authors or fund letters, etc.? A long question, but I'm currently reading The Intelligent Investor, which is Ben Graham's book, and all the bond talk, etc., seems so irrelevant. Cheers, lads. Thanks in advance. Good question, Sam. Love it. Look, I think getting started with the classics, with the fundamental underpinnings of investing, the concepts behind investing, super, super important. But as you say, the way the business has changed since then, I don't think it makes them irrelevant, but it certainly means you have to take the theory and then find out how best to apply it in today's market with today's businesses, metrics, interest rates, as you rightly point out. So with that, Doc, I'm going to throw the hard question to you. Are there any particular books, any particular fund managers, any particular authors, any particular followers on social media? How do you take your investing kind of principles and basics and then use sort of some more currency to help inform the way you approach investing today?
Okay, so I'm not trying to be promotional here, but I'll say I would put all those books aside from the greats and put Warren Buffett and his letters aside, and I would go to one book, The Motley Fool Investment Guide by David and Tom Gardner. I'm not sucking up to my
oh yes you are
my CEO and our co-chairman.
Is it salary review time? Must be.
I haven't gotten a raise in a while. But honestly, I think that's the book. I would read that book first.
Right.
I think here's the thing with Intelligent Investor, and I think those books are now pretty dated, and I think they basically don't work. I think Peter Lynch's book, actually, One Up on Wall Street, is still very, very relevant.
I'll throw in Phil Fisher too, an old one. Beat in the Street? No, what is it? Common Stocks and Uncommon Profits.
Common Stocks and Uncommon Profits.
Yes.
I think that's another one.
Yes.
Fisher, very few people have records like Fisher and Lynch.
Yep.
So I think those two books are still, I think Christopher Meyer's 100 Baggers is another great book
to look at.
Those are still old, but they've got a lot of value there. And then I think the one book that I would recommend Warren Buffett read as well is Capitalism Without Capital. And this is more of an economics book, but written by economics Haskett, I think, out of the UK. I think these books, I think, give you a more modern context into what's happening in the sort of the low interest rate environment, the innovations driven, technology driven markets. I think the biggest change that you observe from the Ben Graham days or the Buffett days to now is you can actually build companies without really investing dollars in the sense of like building factories and things like that.
Yeah.
And I think that has changed a lot of things. So it's the internet, the cloud, 5G, iPhone, the App Store. Those things have really changed how business is done.
Yep.
So I think that context. I think the Buffett letters are really good for underpinning, I think, the investor mindset.
Yeah. Great.
So I think that's if you can abstract out and not be a Buffett investor in the sense that I want to buy moats, because if you want to buy moats, you're buying very mature businesses. But if you can take that and think about the discipline and think about how he thinks of the long term, how he thinks about many ideas like brands, I think those things I think are timeless classics. So there's, again, I think that it's a question of just being right about the time. So I think that's what I would say.
Nice, I like that a lot. I completely agree, actually, for what it's worth. I think, if you think about the Buffetts, Lynches, and Fishers, I think for me, the benefit of those three guys is really underpinning the case for long-term investing. And in very different ways, but there is some sense of how to think about investing, how to invest, how to think about volatility, keep your mind on the job. Even, Sam, I will say for what it's worth, the idea of a margin of safety, I don't think it's invalidated by the changes. I think what it does, you have to think about how you approach it, right? So Buffett's margin of safety would largely come from a calculation of value and then a discount from that calculation. I don't think that's necessarily miles away from the concept that he's trying to, that you can use today. You just don't do it exactly the same way, right? So the idea of margin of safety is simply saying, well, I think it could be this, but I'm not so sure that I want to pay up and assume perfection in my own forecast, right? So let's take Kogan, right? I think Kogan could be X size in 10 years' time. Buffett's never going to buy Kogan, but you can simply say to yourself, right, if it's going to be X size in 10 years' time, I'm going to say, well, I won't buy unless it's going to be, I get a good price at half of that. I think it could be, I can't even conceptualize numbers, Doc. Let's say it's going to be a $1 billion business in 10 years' time. Well, if it's possible, but maybe it doesn't. So I don't want to buy at a price that it has to be $1 billion for me to make money. I want to buy at a price that I'll make money if it gets to half a billion. So if it gets to $1 billion, then I've got even more. So that's the same margin of safety concept, right? And I think this is where people can be too literal. And a lot of Buffett particularly is taken super literally, right? The whole, rule number one, don't lose money. Rule number two, don't forget rule number one. He never meant none of your investments will ever lose money. He just meant invest conservatively so that your portfolio doesn't go to zero. Now, you can take any of those things super literally, and maybe even at the time they weren't intended literally. But I think if you take some of those ideas, again, Peter Lynch's idea about scuttlebutt, for example, I used Kogan as an investor. I used corporate travel as at a previous job. The scuttlebutt method still works really, really, really well. It might be steelmakers, and it might not necessarily even be retailers. But again, the software, the hardware, the services, the technology you use, those things, again, same sort of ideas. So I would absolutely still read those guys. I would just take the approach to say, right, how can I apply that to the industries and businesses and the circumstances that exist today? I think that's well and truly worth doing. I agree with Doc about Capitalism Without Capital. I think that's a really good one. I haven't read 100 Baggers yet. It is on my list of reads, so do that. Man, what else? I think, yeah. Well, are there any followers on social media, mate? Any particular people you follow who are great on tech?
Yeah, so there's a partner from Benchmark called Chetan Puttagunta. I'm probably getting the name, but if, you know, if somebody goes to my feed, you'll see, they will see that I retweet quite a bit. What I like really about him is he tweets a lot of facts about tech, and he reads a lot of transcripts. I think there's a venture they're investing in, like, you know, businesses that are pre-public, right? But he also follows very closely what is happening in sort of the software world, in the tech world, from big companies to small companies, and he would really find nice little nuggets. You need, probably if you need to know one thing from the Microsoft earnings call, it'll be that one thing that he has pointed out. So it's a really easy, straightforward way of getting very good dump. Of course, there's one person's viewpoint that he's amplifying, but I think he has a really good read of what's going on, how technology is evolving. So I actually pay a lot of attention to what he has to say.
Nice.
So there are a few others, I think, that you can read, but I think he's really, really good.
There you go, Sam. Hope that helps. Really, really good stuff there. So yeah, I think you know, take the concepts and apply them your way. Don't distort them. Don't completely undermine them. But you know, these guys are done very, very well for a good reason. Some of it is industry specific. Some of it is point in time. Others of it is stuff that you can actually take. Even they don't be taken. I mean, you know, Buffett himself said he doesn't do tech. Doc does tech, does it really, really well. I don't think it necessarily needs to be an either or conversation, right? You can take what you learned from Buffett and apply it to tech in the same kind of way. Well, let's move on, mate, to a question from David. Hi, Scott and Doc. I love your work and the honest and transparent approach you bring to stock market investing. Thank you, mate. I heard your comments regarding gold on the mailbag edition from the 12th of July. I agree that in the long term, the market is likely a better way to build wealth than gold. The problem is that right now, there's a sense the share market is getting a little ahead of its reality and is ripe for a reality check. Anecdotally, I'm hearing a lot of people claiming right now cash is king. Last week, my kid's maths tutor, my accountant, and my business partner all independently said they'd pulled money out of shares to cash before the market tanks again. I presently have more than half of my net worth in shares and I'm happy to ride the roller coaster to an extent. But I do want to keep some cash available for picking up bargains in any short-term fire sales. The problem is nobody knows if and when such a correction will occur. Cash in the bank is paying such poor interest and will do so for a while. Money in the bank seems like opportunity lost. When central banks are effectively printing money and dropping rates, doesn't gold act as a good portfolio insurance strategy? Shouldn't the value of gold be viewed not as a competitor against shares, but as an alternative to cash in the bank right now? Gold has some tailwinds in an uncertain world. If the stock markets fall, the gold will often rally. What do you think of an allocation to gold if the only alternative is cash in the bank? Full on, and leave poor Doc alone. Social media is overrated. David, I'll take that as a comment, as Tony Jones would say. I can't leave Doc alone entirely. That's part of the fun of the podcast. But yeah, maybe a little bit. All right, mate, I'll let you have first go at this one. Shares, gold, cash. Is gold at least an alternative, if not to shares, to cash in the bank?
I don't have a view on this, really. I mean, the problem I have with gold is the price of gold really depends on supply, cost of production, demand, and you know, all of those things that, you know, and the sentiment as well. So it's really hard for me to know what gold is going to do. And if I don't know what it's going to do, then how is it a hedge? I mean, it's not really a hedge for me.
Yeah.
If I had to hedge, I would buy put options on an index. Because that is a hedge. You know, if I want to hedge against a 10% decline, I would then buy put options 3 months out on an index that I think, you know, I want to protect my portfolio against. And that's a lot of professional investors do that hedging. I actually used to do that. I've stopped doing that largely because you hedge 10 times and you're right once.
Yeah,
and effectively, you pay premium
all
those 10 times to get the one-time benefit. Net-net, you're neither here, neither there if you can tolerate the volatility. That's that. If you've got cash, I mean, cash is really a hedge as well, right? I mean, in portfolios that we run, or at least I run, in one portfolio, I've got a decent amount of cash sitting. And when I say decent, it's like 10% or so. And I call it cash, basically a hedge. That's another form of hedge that you can have. There's another form of hedge that you can have, and it depends on really how your portfolio is allocated. Well, let's assume that your portfolio is allocated mostly to the ASX, right? So then if you own an index ETF, that is effectively a mirror of a dollar denominated ETF,
right?
So for example, NASDAQ's 100, then that's a form of hedge too, at least against the local dollar. Because if what happens is, if our economy really suffers, our dollar basically goes down relative to the US dollar, and you get a hedge.
So it's kind of currency geography hedge.
It's a currency geography hedge. Right. But the currency hedge actually works really well in that context, because you know typically commodity currencies react that way, right?
Yep.
So you know, so that's another sort of hedge. There's a lot of different ways to hedge. Ultimately, I think hedging, the best hedge is diversification. The second best hedge is to have some cash to deploy. Everything else is very cute, and unless you have a specific reason, like if you want to hold, for example, a NASDAQ 100, then you basically believe the NASDAQ 100 is going to give you market beating returns, plus you're getting some hedging benefits on the side.
Right.
That's okay, but I would not buy NASDAQ 100 just for the heck of getting some hedging, if that makes sense. So that's so broad, different levels or ways of thinking about hedging.
I'm going to take a different, the same view as you really are fundamentally, Doc, maybe a little bit harsh, more harsher than you did. David, I take your point. Here's the thing, right? Portfolio insurance or portfolio hedging is really a volatility smoothing strategy. And this is why it's really, really important, right? Because so let's say the share market is going to double over the next 5 years. Let's say 10 years to make it, I'm not trying to over-egg the pudding here, right? Let's say it's going to double in the next 10 years. Now, if I could invest now and get that double, I'd take the double, right? I put $100 down and get $200 back in a decade. Now, I think it'd be quicker than that, but let's just assume that's what's going to happen. Now, I could, and during that next decade, there could be 2-30% falls on the way to that double. So it falls in 2025 and again 2028. Again, just pick some numbers, right? Now, I could have insurance right for the next 10 years. And as Doc said, you could buy put options, you could buy gold, you could do whatever. And I could have those 2-30% falls be less. Maybe it's only 15%. For me personally, because I've hedged, right? Maybe it's 10, maybe it's even plus 2, whatever the numbers are. If I've actually literally buying this for insurance that only pays out sometimes, the other 8 years when the market doesn't fall 30%, I'm costing myself money. It is very, very, very likely in my view that over the next decade, you end up with $180 rather than $200. And yes, you've hedged. Yes, you've got insurance. Yes, you've helped yourself with volatility. You actually end up with less money. That's kind of the problem with insurance policies, right? Like, you know, unless there's no free lunch in those hedges, there just isn't. Otherwise, it would be priced out. The market's pretty clever, and particularly in those zero sum entities, where if I'm gaining, you're losing, or vice versa, the idea of those things is they should be pretty rationally priced most of the time. Now, maybe you get lucky. The one time you hedge, maybe you win, or the five times you hedge, maybe you lose each of those five, and you miss the other one, which you know you should have been hedged. Certainly, I know people who tried to hedge years ago, stopped doing it, and the market fell this year, and they weren't hedged at that point because they'd already given up. They paid the insurance policy for 5 years and then didn't have the insurance when they needed it. I think honestly, over time, if you can stomach the volatility, I would absolutely forever be unhedged. I just don't see the value in being hedged for a reason. As Doc says, even if you want to have some diversification, get that diversification stuff that's going to go up rather than stuff that's going to do well if the rest of the portfolio does badly. All you're doing is smoothing volatility and you're paying for the privilege. Now, if you need to, if you're an investor, excuse me, if David, you're an investor or one of our listeners is an investor who just can't literally stomach the volatility and it's the only way you can stay invested is to have a hedge, then go for it. If but just recognize that in almost all cases, you're accepting a lower total return for less volatility, which is fine. And that's completely okay. Just realize that's what you're doing. So while you want to be either comfortable or feel smart, that you've got something to go up when something else goes down, that can feel better and that might be enough, but it's almost certainly going to cost you over the long term. That fair to say, Doc?
I think that's correct. I completely agree with them.
On the same token, by the way, I'm unlike Doc a little bit. We're a little bit different. I'm actually almost always try to be fully invested. I'm actually about, funnily enough, to your point, about 10% of my portfolio is in cash right now, just because I added money to have bought anything recently. I've been getting to buy for weeks, and just for different compliance reasons, other things haven't done it. I can be often in more cash than I'm comfortable with. I would, again, for me, I'd rather not have the cash. I don't want the hedge. I'd actually rather take the big fall if I get the big gain. If I was fully invested in February and March when the market fell, I would have been able to get the full rally, right? I actually missed out on some of that rally because I was in cash when the market jumped 35%. And now I feel like I've missed some of the trick. Now, it doesn't kill me. I'm not too worried about it. But again, the kind of idea there is by all means, be diversified, have some cash if that's what you want. Just recognize again that over time, cash will underperform shares. And so if you're holding cash for the whole time, you are to some degree, there's a little bit of a handbrake on your returns, a little bit of lead in the saddlebags that maybe you don't need to carry. Fair to say, dude?
I think so.
value stocks,
markets,
stock market,
index,
share market.
This is Motley Fool Money. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
How about we go to a question from Bernard? Now, Bernard's got an interesting question to ask us, mate. Bernard says, hello, Captain and Doc. G'day, Bernard. I continue to love the podcast and Motley Fool services. Nice work. Well done. Thank you. Your answers to my previous questions have helped me and my portfolio returns a lot. Thank you. Well, you're welcome, Bernard. We do hope to help all of our listeners and all of our members improve their portfolio returns. So if we've done that, hopefully we're doing the right thing, mate. Thank you. He says, I'd appreciate your perspective on something that's bugging me, i.e. the pedestrian returns from my industry super fund as compared to my full self-managed portfolio. Both have about the same invested amount. I went full fool only 2 years ago, i.e. buying Motley Fool subscriptions, EO, that's Extreme Opportunities, SA, Share Advisor, and Rule Breakers, which is one of our US services, and I've only been actively investing for 3 years, so I could be experiencing beginner's luck, a lack of perspective, newbie's no idea, or a fool's paradise. But when I compare my full portfolio returns, about 20% per year, yes, I know, only the last 2 years, with my industry super funds of about 6% a year, I'm worried about these low returns going forward. With about 15 years until I can retire, barring any unforeseen problems, that's a lot of underperformance to soak up. How can I, with the fool's huge assistance, be beating the pros? Could I, should I consider starting my own self-managed super fund? I don't have and won't have anytime soon anywhere near the $1 million, which is what I hear you need to make an SMSF effective. What do you think? All right. Doc, in terms of the full portfolio versus industry super fund or something else, what say you? Should he take the whole thing and go full fool with his super as well?
Well, again, I wouldn't tell him what to do because I can't. But here's the thing. Like, I'd guess the industry super fund has a lot of beautiful banks and a couple of beautiful grocers, and these are businesses that are not really growing.
Right.
So, I mean, it's not that there are no growth businesses on the ASX. There are. It's just not those top 30, 40, 50 businesses that you're looking
right.
at. You've got to look outside that to find growth on the ASX. I mean, that's
yep.
what I mean. And then there, industry super fund might be investing in commercial real estate and, other things and, unlisted assets. I don't know what they do, but I'm guessing there's all these other things that impact returns. They might even hold a portion in cash, depending upon the strategy that one has selected. So that's that. I think the requirement, so I'll answer the question differently about the SMSF. Mm. The answer that you need $1 million to start your SMSF, I think too high,
yep.
in my opinion.
Way too high.
Way too high. I have an SMSF and I can tell you it doesn't have that kind of money in it.
Yet.
Hopefully get there someday. My own experience is you could do it with 200K.
Yeah.
There's more compliance cost, audit cost and all those things with doing it. But I mean, if somebody can compound at 15 and you're getting 6, that's the 9% is, it's a big difference. 9% compounded over 10, 15, 20 years is a huge difference, right? But of course, there's a lot of commitment involved in doing it in a way. You have to be invested in the thought of actually doing it itself, right?
Yes,
which is very important. And it's a commitment that one has to have.
Good point.
So, one has to consider the cost of doing, the process of doing, the mental cost of doing it versus outsourcing it to someone for it to be done. So that's what I would say. So you don't need $1 million, in my opinion,
correct.
At least to do it is what I would say.
Yep. I'll absolutely echo that. A couple hundred grand is about as much as you need. And even less than that, frankly, if you want to build your portfolio over time to a decent size, starting with a slightly uneconomic portfolio, but billion, when Doc ends up with $15 million in his super fund, he'll be glad he spent an extra couple of dollars early on because he's now got a super fund he could build himself, and the compound returns well and truly justified some of the prices early on. And I think that's where, in the past, I've been guilty of this, mate, of saying brokerage should be X percent or your fee should be X percent of your portfolio. And I think that's kind of right at a basic level. But if you can compound whatever wealth you're creating meaningfully over time and start by starting with the right place in the right way, Those early fees can well and truly pay themselves multiple times over, right? If I'm going to pay – if my $20 brokerage on a $500 trade is high, and it is, if that starts me on a journey to $1 million portfolio, then that $20 out of my $1 million is not much at all. So, you know, there is – you know, I've been a little bit arbitrary on that before, and it's easier to be arbitrary because it's easier to sell a message. But given we've got a bit of a longer form opportunity here to have a chat, I think that's where I'd probably say it's worth just having to think about how that might net out, because you can, I think, in particular – do you know better with that in terms of the way you invest? Here's the thing. This is also, Bernard, something that's really worth thinking about, right? Doc mentioned the banks. It's not only just that, right? If you're in a balanced fund, you're going to be having property, cash, other, you know, bigger businesses, as Doc says, all the sort of stuff compiled in. Now, that's not necessarily a terrible portfolio or a terrible fund approach if you take that view. Now, super funds as a rule will have much less volatility than the average portfolio, because my personal portfolio is 100% shares. My SMSF is also 100% shares. Most SMSFs will be, you know, or sorry, most industry funds will be, I don't know, 40% Australian shares, 20% international shares, 20% profit, 10% cash, and whatever number I haven't come up with in between there. If I'm 110% or 90%, then fill in the gaps. But, you know, that very idea is, you know, it's really important one. They are conducting a very, very different strategy. And so nothing wrong with industry super funds as an approach. I like them much more than retail super funds for what it's worth. But in terms of the way, you should expect lower returns. You absolutely should expect lower returns from the premixed options, because they're not trying to maximize the yearly return or even the total return. They are trying to give you a smoother ride, because frankly, most members need that, right? My mother, when she had a super fund, would come to me sometimes and say, "My super's gone down this year. How can it go down? Why am I contributing to super if it goes down sometimes?" And that's not a slight of my mum. That's just someone who isn't an investor, doesn't listen to podcasts like this one, and kind of thinks, "Well, hang on, super's supposed to go up. Why would I bother contributing if it goes down sometimes?" That's you know, the average member of a super fund is really, really different to the average listener to a podcast like this or an average member of one of our services. I would say inside industry super, I wouldn't rush away to an SMSF, by the way. If you want to and it's right for you, as Doc says, do it. But if you're in inside industry super, you can almost certainly choose, firstly, the investment style. So you can go to a high growth rather than balanced, should you choose to, and that'll give you more exposure to shares, which should give you more volatility, but hopefully over time a higher return. Most industry funds will let you invest 80% of your fund directly into shares yourself. You can choose the shares you invest in and the ETFs you invest in. So you can, inside the fund structure, still make some of your own decisions, which put you in a pretty good place. So SMSF, if you want to and you're keen, as Doc says, have a look at it. Depends on your account balance. If you're not or don't want to or not ready yet, just go back to your industry fund and find out what the individual options are. You think you'll be surprised and pleasantly surprised at how much control you can have over your investments and the way you can start to put some of that money to work. Anything else on that, Doc?
No, sir.
Beautiful. Let's move on to a question from AJ in Tasmania. How good is that, Tasmanian listener?
I love Tasmania.
I love Tasmania too. It's a lovely place. We love our Taswegian listeners. Question says, "Hi, I'm a very amateur investor. And early on, I invested in ISX." Now, I signed this, as I recall. Is that right? ISX?
Yeah, ISX. I signed this, yes.
"Everything was looking really good until, as you know, they got into a fight with the ASX. They are now considering delisting from the ASX and relisting it on a different exchange. And I believe in the AGM, this move was strongly supported. What happens next? Can I expect that they delist and relist that I will suddenly have shares on a different exchange that I'm not currently registered with? Am I able to register and trade through these platforms like I do with the rest of my Australian shares if I use CommSec? I'm just not sure where the shares will go and how I might manage them, or if there are tax implications." Now, AJ, first thing is, there were no tax implications on a change of exchange. Think of the exchange as, it's a very imprecise example, but let's assume, as the real estate agent you're selling by your house through. You still own the house. If you take away from Ray White and list it with LJ Hooker, take away from LJ Hooker and list it with Ray White, the way it gets sold, the mechanism that's used to buy or sell the shares or quote the price, doesn't impact on the asset that you own. It may impact the price you get depending on how many buyers and sellers are at that exchange. If I started scottstockexchange.com, I dare say I'm not going to have many buyers or sellers on that exchange. And so if I was trying to sell my shares on that exchange, I might assume that the buyers might be few and far between. So it might be harder to sell. You might get a different price. But there's no tax implication on the change because you own the shares, nobody else. And your cost base is your cost base is your cost base. Similarly, what you sell it for, that determines it. And the exchange doesn't really matter in that case. In terms of releasing on a different exchange, look, I find this a really ugly fight, frankly. I think You know, someone who's had taken a combative approach to it, the regulator, is probably a difficult business to remain invested in because you just simply don't know well enough what's going on. Equally, I think they're actually not totally wrong in the way they've addressed some of the ASX's concerns relative to the lack of action the ASX has taken with the big banks, for example, in similar circumstances. So it's a really, really messy circumstance. The last thing for me, and Doc, I'll ask you for your thoughts if you have any extra ones. We don't yet know if they will change, where they will go, what will be involved, how it all works. So the honest answer right now, AJ, is I don't know the answer. I would far, far rather iSign this actually just get themselves in a position where the market operator and the regulator, ASIC, to the extent the ASIC's involved, were simply happier with the way things were being done. I think that's the best for everybody, quite frankly. Just give them the information they need. If that's the gold standard for information, then I don't see the circumstance that requires iSign this to change exchange rather than simply come to terms with the way shares are bought and sold on the big boards in Australia. But that's, you know, that's just a personal view. Any thoughts on that, Doc?
I really have nothing really to add to that. I mean, yeah. So it's an ugly situation. And the only thing I'll add is it's unclear to me that there'd be, a company which is involved in a fight with, which is a pretty big exchange is going to be able to find another exchange, right? Maybe they can. It's easier to sort things out here than to transfer the registry to another place would be my guess, but I don't know much about this story.
Yeah, it will make it life harder for you as a shareholder either way. The problem is in the meantime, you may not have a choice, right? Because they may not relist in the ASX, they may turn up immediately on the next exchange as you start. So see how you go from there. All right, a question, mate, from Paul. Paul says, "Hi, Scott. Have been listening to your podcast and it is a recurring theme that you avoid margin loans." I feel like I'm going to get a wacky. Hang on. "Josh's story this week," and this was last week, "prompted me to write, as I don't think you have presented a balanced point of view on them. I took out a margin loan in 2007 just prior to the GFC. It turned ugly for everyone then, not just for those who held margin loans. I went through a couple of margin calls and forced selling. A few years later, I got back into the margin loan. I now have gone from $30,000 to over $4 million thanks to the leverage of the margin loan. As my holdings increase, I also increase my loan amount. It is a comfortable 25 to 30% LVR, or loan to valuation ratio. Now, for those who don't know, if it's 25% LVR, that means the debt is 25% of the asset value. If you've got $10,000 in shares, a 25% LVR would mean a loan of $2,500. So 25% of the price or the value of the shares. I'm now extracting $1 million from the portfolio to buy a house," says Paul. "Nearly everyone borrows money to buy a house, often at 60, 70 or 80% LVRs. Then spends the rest of their life paying off the mortgage to provide themselves with shelter. This is thought to be okay and normal, but to me, this is a terrible use of money. There is no way in a single decade I could have built this wealth to enable me to buy a house without the margin loan facility. So in summary, you need to keep an open mind on margin loans. Like any investment, it needs to be managed. And if the person is not capable of managing their investments, then they shouldn't do it. But for those who are able to stay in a safe zone and not fly too close to the sun, a margin loan is an incredible tool to build wealth. Regards, Paul." It's a pretty spirited defense of the margin loan. Doc, what do you say?
By and large, actually, I'd agree with him. But like any, the couple of differences I would point out. One is a margin loan typically attracts a higher interest rate. So, I mean, if somebody gave me a margin loan at 2%, that's very different from somebody giving me a margin loan at 8%. Because then the gap required to perform is significantly higher. That's number one. Number two is, there can be margin call on debt as well on your on, and you know it's relatively uncommon, but it has happened in the past. And similarly, margin calls can happen on investment accounts. So I mean, here's a point there. I mean, if you are managing it conservatively, then you can actually make it work as long as you're not paying too much in interest. But if you're paying too much in interest relative to the gains you're making, then you've got a bit of a problem. So, yeah, like I mean, in principle, I think the reason we say no is the chance that you the chance that you mess up and stuff gets sold automatically is pretty high.
Yeah.
I shouldn't say pretty high, but the cost that if that happens is pretty high, because if your portfolio got automatically sold of stuff, and the sold got sold at the wrong time, then you basically have destroyed years of effort, right? And that's the reason we say. But yeah, if somebody knows how to use it, maybe that's fine. And that's my viewpoint.
Yeah, I agree. I think. So here's the thing. Here's the thing, Paul. I have to say, mate, well done. So congratulations. The problem we have overall is that, like anything, any tool could be great, any tool could be terrible, used terribly, used badly, be very lucky, very unlucky. All those things can be true. And the anecdote of one success or one failure shouldn't determine whether or not something is useful. What it does do, though, is remind us that there are a massive range of outcomes for people. And in, Paul, I'm sure you're a smart, sensible, thoughtful investor, and so this is not directed at you specifically, but you know, in a parallel universe, you might have got to $750,000 and lost a lot when the market crashed. So, you know, the hey, here's what I got to, I did well, slash was, you know, did well and had some luck, slash, you know, just a genius, may be true. Remember, of course, this is one I always want to go to. It's really misunderstood, Doc, and not very well remembered. There's a business called Long-Term Capital Management. It was a business in the US, a hedge fund run by 12 Nobel laureates. That's not nothing, right? I don't know where else you'd find 12 Nobel laureates in a room, but this business in the US had 12 Nobel laureates, and they had done all this risk analysis, all these models that told them what was going to happen, what wasn't going to happen, and they made a fortune, and made a fortune, and made a fortune, and made a fortune, and then lost the entire lot. Quite literally, the business went broke, dead broke. And you know, despite all of the smarts, all of the abilities, all of the previous success, you only need to roll 1-0, and the whole thing goes to nothing, right? And so, no matter how well you do up to any point, if you put yourself in a position where the wrong circumstances could take you to zero, then you're in a real world of hurt. And Paul, as you say, I can't argue your stats. There are other people out there with the same experience, and good luck to them, good on them. Overall, do I think it's a wise thing for people to do? No, I don't, because the risk of that zero for unforeseen circumstances is not worth taking. If I get to 55 and have had 40 years of great, 35 years of great investing experience, and then I make one bad mistake that takes my portfolio to zero, I don't want to start again at 55. It's not worth it. The risk return is simply not there. So, Paul, get it. It's been successful for you. Fantastic. That's great. No argument. No grief there. Mate, not even going to try and justify it or explain otherwise. Good luck. Well done. Really well done. What I worry about is that if the circumstances were reversed and the margin loan 07 you got the margin calls for was actually this margin loan, not the other margin loan, you might have had a margin call on $1 million worth of shares. And if that was going to wipe you out, then that's the sort of thing that you really don't want to have to start again from zero, whatever age you end up at. So knock yourself out. I still believe very strongly that for most people, I would say everybody, because I think you don't know which one of those people you're going to be. For every Paul, there's a Jim or a Jeff or a Sally who's lost everything. Does Sally's loss justify Jim's gain or vice versa? Well, I don't know. But what I do know is I don't want any of our listeners to be in the position of finding themselves having to start again. All right, mate, this one's... I promised us a non-human question. Here it is. Scott and Doc, love the podcast. I learnt so much from the two of you. I know you like to hear from female listeners, but what about dogs? Surely I'm not the only dog who is an avid listener of Motley Fool Money. Listening to your podcast is one of my favourite pastimes, especially when my humans go about their daily lives. They rely on me for their investment information as they are pretty busy. I have the following question for you. You previously mentioned in one of your recent pods that some of the main things you look for when assessing a company is a good business plan and quality management. This might be a silly question or super obvious. Keep in mind I am a dog, but how do you know if a business plan is good and if management is quality? I hope you air my question as I would have felt I've made it in life. Spreading the word to all of my dog friends to tune in. Woof. Hashtag keep Doc off Insta. It's a tough gig upholding an image online these days. Well, a dog would know, Doc. So maybe I've been wrong this entire time.
I love the dog.
This is from Koji on Instagram. If you're going to be a dog on social media, it's got to be Instagram, right?
I love it.
There you go. Thank you, Koji. Our first dog question.
I love it, Koji. Thanks, mate, for the for the woof question. I love it. What can I say? Well,
yeah, exactly. I think that's the appropriate start to this question.
The appropriate start is really, what can I say? Can you know is a business, so when you say business plan, I guess, is the business overall high quality and is the management high quality?
Business model, yeah.
Yeah, so business model. In effect, you can never say anything with 100% certainty. So the answer to that would be that you can't. If it's a yes and no question, yep, the answer is no. But you can look at execution. You can look at what's going on. You can look at... you can look at things like if the business says that there's a lot of market opportunity, then you would expect to see a lot of growth, right? If there's a lot of market potential, but there's no growth, there's something, there's a there's a misfit of some form, right? You know, the dog loves the bone, but the, you know, if the dog is not chewing the bone, there's something wrong. so that's that sort of thing. Now, the same thing with management. Again, the management that says things that don't happen or are regularly failing at what they project or how they think the business should execute, then that's that's a dig at the management team. So they think it's not probably not a good management. Then over time, so these are more for early stage businesses, but more and more as the business evolves and becomes more mature, you want to see how a management is allocating capital, right? Mm-hmm. So capital allocation is a big deal. So, you know, you might have $10 billion of cash available. What are you doing with it? Are you giving it back to your investors or the owners of the company as dividend? Are you investing it in, you know, to make acquisitions to and to grow your empire? If you're growing your empire, are you doing the right things? If you're making acquisitions, how much are you paying for those acquisitions? Are you paying too much, right? So all, you know, basically how capital is being managed and whether or not it is in the long-term interest of the business is sort of what you can look at.
Yeah,
a lot of these things are qualitative. Some of these things are quantitative. And a lot of these things are evolutionary in the sense that, you know, you can't look at one snapshot in time. You have to look at over a period of snapshots in time to sort of to an assessment.
It's obviously the right question, for what it's worth, a really good question for a dog. I think the one thing I'd say is it's obviously a dog's obviously you can't know for sure. The other thing is that if it was that easy to do, everyone would already be doing it. And if you're picking stocks, you are looking for businesses that the rest of the market doesn't price as highly as you think that they're worth by definition, right? So it was easy enough to do, everyone would do it. And these are really hard questions. There are plenty of people out there who do this investing gig. And they tell you how easy it is and how a formula can be used or a black box trading software because all you have to do is X, Y, and Z. Excuse me. And everything's done. That's all you have to do, right? It's just literally plug the numbers in, pay them a fortune, and it'll spit out a result and you can buy the stocks that no one else knows about. That's hard, right? It's really hard. It's why at The Motley Fool, we're right about 6 times out of 10, Doc, on average, give or take. And we have to accept that. Like, that's just the reality, right? So how can we know? We can't know for sure. Even with the best information, you can't know for sure because if we did, as I said, there'd be no opportunities to beat the market. In terms of – so management, here's the thing. I look for candor, so honesty, upfrontness, track record. So now be a little bit careful with management. I'm a little bit skeptical of kind of management success kind of it's almost that – I won't get religious, but the idea of prosperity theology, right? The idea that, you know, if you just believe it, it's all going to go well. A manager who's done well in one business maybe is a genius, or maybe just in the right place at the right time. You know, it was hard not to make money. In some industries at certain times, just because the consumers were rushing it, you couldn't keep away with pitchforks, and so you know you can make money doing that. You could be so. Alan Joyce, I think, is one of the best CEOs in the business in airlines. Terrible industry. So would I invest in his business? No, but you know, a really good manager in a tough industry versus someone who can be, you know, literally Warren Buffett's ham sandwich, can run a business that has people throwing money at them because they just are. If you're selling online, you know, products online the last 3 months, you don't have to be a genius to do well in that, right? And so there is going to be a question over time of which CEOs of public online companies have done well because people are just throwing money at them and which are genuinely really, really good at their jobs. We'll see a whole lot of, you know, articles written about these geniuses running online businesses, and You'd do well. We'd all do well. Just to remember that some of that's just circumstantial. So be very, very careful. But track record in more than one industry or for a long period of time is a really, really good sign. Mark Fitzgibbon at NIB is a guy I rate very highly. Alan Joyce, as I mentioned, even in a tough industry, his numbers don't say this guy's a genius, he's made a fortune for everybody. But man, if you can keep an airline out of bankruptcy for a decade, seriously, that's about as good as it gets when it comes to management quality. So, you know, keep that in mind. But candor, honesty, ideally, if you can, a CEO who's either a founder or who has a lot of their personal wealth invested in the company is a good sign they're there for the long term. They are really genuinely trying to improve things and make things great. Again, not always the case, but a good starting point and a good way to try and minimize the risks or at least, you know, put the odds further in your favor. Those are probably the things I'm looking for specifically. A bit of humility is always good. I desperately don't like arrogance in investors or management, so take that for what it's worth. In terms of business model, to Doc's point, often success itself, it's we talk about winners keep on winning. We talk about adding doc in particular, about adding regularly to winning positions. It tends to be the case that businesses that are winning, doing well, are growing, aren't at the end of their growth. Sometimes they are, but often they are. They still have plenty to go, right? If the results will tell you if they're doing something right. If you can get good profit levels, growing profits, growing sales, better, you know, consumer perception, more repeat purchase, depending on the product, depending on the customer or the company, that's a pretty good sign, right? And if you have things like, and again, sustainable competitive advantage. We did a whole episode on moats. So I'm not sure if your humans let you listen to that one, Koji, but if they didn't, go back and check that one out. You know, moats are controversial. We did talk a little bit about that in that episode. So take that, you know, with a bit of grain of salt and have a think about how it applies. But man, if you've got a business with a great brand, I'd rather have a business with a great brand than one without a great brand. I'd rather have a business with a price advantage than one without one. I'd rather have a business with network effects than one without one. And so if you start to, again, add those things together, and start to say, hang on, what is it about these businesses that helps them win? Are those things likely to continue? It's kind of not that hard. And I think I got to say, you know, we got a question on Twitter. We're not going to use it as part of mailbag, but someone said to me, oh, it's a Doc and I basically. If companies, you know, if we just keep on winning, why doesn't it work in the funds management world? Part of the answer, honestly, is there's not a lot of sustainable competitive advantage in that world. You can continue to, you know, Apple can bring in more customers over time, sell more products, charge a higher price. It's very hard as a fund manager to actually make those kind of attributes work for you in the funds world, but it's really, really possible outside that. And so if Apple starts winning in 2005 and still winning in 2009 and still winning in 2013, still winning in 2018, you know, there's a pretty good chance they're going to keep on winning for a decent amount of time. Not forever. Eventually, everyone hits a ceiling in terms of how big they can grow. Now, Apple might have 45 years left for all I know, but I've used the example before. Coke has lots of those competitive advantages. The market just isn't big enough for it to keep growing. So I made a mistake there because I went, how good is this business? Got all these things I love. And they were all right. I think in hindsight, I still believe the analysis is right on those things. What it didn't allow for is there's not a lot of opportunity left for it to use those for growth. So if there's no growth coming, Doc's already mentioned the total market size. If you're already against the ceiling, then you want to be really, really careful. So hopefully that kind of helps. There is no single playbook, right? If we had one, either we'd be billionaires or we'd be selling it or everyone would know it. And in any of those cases, we wouldn't be here. So we have to acknowledge we're accepting volatility and uncertainty. But those are the sorts of things from a management and business model level I'm looking for when I'm picking my stocks. And Doc's already given you his answers. Any more on that, Doc, after my ramble?
No, I think your ramble is spot on.
I think it was a bit of damning with faint praise then?
No.
It was spot on, but it was still a ramble.
Oh, what was it? You called it a ramble. I agreed with it. Today was the agreement.
I loaded the gun.
I've just agreed with everything.
I loaded the gun.
And I think it's spot on.
Now, speaking of picking good companies, I run Motley Fool Share Advisor. Doc runs Extreme Opportunities. We talked about him on Friday, so I'm going to talk about me today because, hey, sometimes I just want to talk about me. You can join Share Advisor really easily and pretty cheaply. Not quite as cheap as EO, but pretty cheap. Go to fool.com.au/SA podcast. Less than a cup of coffee a week, which frankly, again, if you can, you know, no promises, no guarantees. We are beating the market. We're pretty happy with that. Though we're never satisfied. We're always trying to do better and better. But if you can make a couple of dollars a week out of your investments that you're investing alongside the advice we give you, I reckon that'll more than pay for its membership. Hopefully. Again, no guarantees. The future is unknown, as we just finished saying. But if you want to find some of the better medium and large cap companies on the ASX, and by the way, we do a US recommendation every month too. We've talked a lot about US investing, so that's one way to get yourself some US recommendations, plus, as I said, some market-beating ASX recommendations. Go to fool.com.au/SA podcast. I run Share Advisor with our foolish colleague, Andrew Leggett, who is a gun, and we have a lot of fun. We have a good time putting out some more content and a lot of great recommendations that I think hopefully we'll continue to do and hopefully you will benefit from. So fool.com.au/SA podcast for a very special podcast price on joining Share Advisor. Before we go, mate, we want more mailbag questions. So listeners, dear listeners, please give us some feedback, suggestions, and preferably for this particular type of episode, some more questions. Now, Doc, I will say here's a couple of I'm gonna blow our own trumpet for a second, or I'm gonna let other people blow our trumpet. I just went to the podcast page, and I'm always a bit scared to do that, but we got a 5-star review from Zoom85 most recently, who said, "Only time for one. This is the podcast to listen to." That's very kind. Thank you, Zoom85. I won't read the rest of it because, frankly, Listeners already are listening, so they don't need to be told how good we are. But I appreciate it. Thank you. We got great advice and discussion from Sea Widow and no BS investment advice from Darwin Salty. So thank you, Fools, for giving us some positive feedback. We really do appreciate it. We'll assume it's genuine and legitimate. So thank you for taking the time. Thank you for giving us some good feedback, because we do this for effectively nothing. We should get paid by the boss, but not for doing this particular podcast. So we appreciate all of the feedback and suggestions. Hit us up, info@fool.com.au. is our email address if you're an email kind of person. If you're a social kind of person, we'll get Doc on Instagram soon. We'll start with Twitter this time, because Doc's there, at Anirban Mahanti. Get him on Twitter. He's good on Twitter. You want to follow Doc. You can follow me too, at TMF Scott P. And the Motley Fool's account is at The Motley Fool AU. Give us a follow. Come and have a chat. We love interacting with our listeners. If you're on Instagram, as all the cool kids are, if you're taking photos of smashed Avo breakfasts, then you want to hit me up at TMF Scott P again, or The Motley Fool at The Motley Fool AU. And if you're a Facebook kind of person, and who isn't, well, other than Doc, you can go to at The Motley Fool Australia on Facebook, or Scott Phillips Money. All right, mate, that's it. We're done for this Sunday, this weekend. Hopefully it's a good one if you're enjoying your weekend. Stay safe, Melbourne. Stay safe, Sydney and Adelaide, Brisbane too, I should say. Do the right thing, guys. Just keep your – wash your hands. Stay distant. Put your mask on if you need to. We will beat this thing if we all work together, but you're going to have to put a bit of effort in. So please do that. Stay safe. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. And, of course, do subscribe to the Triple M Motley Fool Money podcast through iTunes, your favorite Android podcast app, or – the Podcast One app. And if you like what we're doing, please do what Zoom85, Sea Widow and Darwin Salty did. Tell your friends, tell strangers, write at the sky, or at least leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Who could use a bit of foolishness in their lives? That's it for this week's Motley Fool Money. We'll be back on Tuesday with some money hacks and a bit of more foolish insight. Fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.